Thank you.
Okay. Today is Thursday, July 22nd, 2010. My name is Meredith Horn, a graduate student of public history and the intern for an oral history project recording the memories of individuals who have significant association with and knowledge of IUPUI. Funding comes from the University Library, the Department of History's Public History Program, and the University Administration's 40th Anniversary Fund, administered through the IUPUI Office of Community Relations. Today I am interviewing Dr. Gerald Bepko, who in 1979 was named Associate Dean of Academic Affairs. From 1981 to 1986 was the Dean of the Law School, and in 1986 accepted the title of IUPUI's Chancellor and Indiana University's Vice President for Long-Range Planning. Is that correct?
It is correct, but the title Vice President for Long-Range Planning didn't come until a few years later. The original conception of those titles of Vice President was that there would be a campus head, and that would be a Vice President of Indiana University. In fact, in 1974, I think they changed the title of the people who were then in place in Bloomington and Indianapolis from Chancellor to Vice President.
Okay.
It was a part of a reorganization that was conducted in the university. It was a response to a report filed by a high-level committee that had studied Indiana University's organization because it was becoming more and more complex. Indianapolis was growing. People were concerned about laying an organizational plan that would accommodate the growth in the various parts of the university. So they appointed York Wilburn, who was a professor in, public and environmental affairs in Bloomington, and they called it the Wilburn Committee. The Wilburn Committee made a whole series of recommendations, many of which had to do with the relationships between Bloomington and Indianapolis. For example, it was out of the Wilburn Committee report that we created merged schools and some system schools, which operated at both Bloomington and Indianapolis. The School of Public and Environmental Affairs became one school. The faculty was recruited by one dean. There was an associate dean here in Indianapolis, but the dean for the school was actually in Bloomington. Same with the School of Business. As there was a School of Business growing up here,
right.
It became part of the School of Business in Bloomington with the dean in Bloomington and an executive associate dean here. Looking at it the other way, School of Nursing had the dean here and there was an associate dean in Bloomington, or the Dean of Medicine was here, but there was an associate dean or a director of the program in Bloomington that reported to the dean here. The idea was that these were what were called a core campus of Indiana University, or core campuses of Indiana University, and that all came out of the Wilburn report. At the same time, they changed the titles of the people who were the heads of the campuses. In the past, they were called chancellors. In 1969, when Maynard Hein was appointed as the first head of the campus here, he was appointed as chancellor. In 1973, when Glenn Irwin was in that office, or 1974, I guess it was, Glenn had been in office about a year before this happened, I think they changed the title from chancellor to vice president. Now, it was an effort to show the importance of these offices and the fact that they were a part of the senior executive core of the university. They were then invited to regular staff meetings in Bloomington. When the other vice presidents got together, there was also the vice president for Indianapolis and the vice president for Bloomington. In fact, they became increasingly important in the whole university administration. It was only later that the title chancellor was added back in, because for quite a number of years, including at the time I was appointed, when I was appointed it was as vice president of Indiana University for the Indianapolis campus.
Mm-hmm.
It was a couple of years later when Miles Brand became president, that he asked, well, actually, I guess it may have been before Miles became president, but Ken Gross Lewis in Bloomington was more concerned about this because he was there on a campus where he was the vice president for the campus, but then there was a president in the same building. So when people came to visit, they would say, well, Ken, I know you're the vice president, but where's the president?
Yeah.
In Indianapolis, it was a little easier because you could say, well, yes, I'm vice president of IU, and then I'm head of the campus.
Right.
It was a little more awkward to say that when you're in the same building as the office of the president.
Yeah.
So Ken wanted to add back in the title of chancellor, and the trustees agreed to that. But then when Miles came, he said, if you're chancellor, then what are you vice president of? He said, we've got to give you a title or a responsibility in my senior administration in addition to the title chancellor. We want it to be vice president of something.
Yeah.
So Ken was appointed vice president for academic affairs, and I was appointed vice president for long-range planning, owing to the fact that I was here in Indianapolis, closer to the General Assembly and state government, and also owing to the fact that Miles was planning a university-wide strategic planning effort. And it was probably better to have somebody who was based here in Indianapolis who could relate both to Bloomington. I knew Bloomington pretty well. I had taught in Bloomington several times as a visiting professor. And also somebody who was more approachable by the other campuses, because BYU had some of the characteristics of the regional campuses, and I think that made sense for me to be the vice president for long-range planning. Since in more recent times, since Charles Bance has been appointed, I think they've changed it again to executive vice president.
Oh.
And to show how that office relates to the other vice presidents. Anyway, yes, I was appointed in 1986 as vice president, and later chancellor.
Chancellor.
And I think they dropped that title.
Yeah. Well, we are currently in the television studio in Kavanaugh Hall on the IUPUI campus, where we are recording in both digital audio and digital video. So I thank you, Dr. Bebko, for agreeing to do this interview. And at this time, I'd like to ask your permission to do the following: to record this interview in both audio and video, to have the interview transcribed, to place the interview and the transcriptions in the IUPUI Special Collections and Archives for the patrons' use, and to deposit the video with the IUPUI Office of Community Relations for such public relations purposes as the appropriate officials in that office deem appropriate.
You have my permission.
Okay. Well, then to begin, I'd like to start by getting to know you, your youth, and your educational background. So to start, where were you born?
I was born in Chicago. I think it was called St. Mary's Hospital on the near west side of Chicago, on Lake Street, I believe it was. My family moved to the northwest side of Chicago. I grew up on the northwest side in the city. Many people, when you meet them in different places around the country or around the world, say, I'm from Chicago. And so, oh, really? I am too. What part?
Yeah.
And then they say, well, Lake Forest or Barrington or some other suburban community that's way far out in the country, as far as I saw it. When I was growing up, the city limits were pretty well marked, and the suburbs were far away places. Anyway, I grew up in the city. I went to public schools, Chicago Public Schools, which are a lot in the news these days, because Arne Duncan was the superintendent of Chicago schools before he became Secretary of Education. I went to the Ernest Pressing Grammar School, where I was the, I guess you could say, either the beneficiary or the victim of a program they had of double promoting students. If you're doing well and could do the work of the class that was ahead of you, they moved you ahead even though you weren't of the age that you should have to get there. So I was double promoted and graduated from grade school about a year earlier than I probably should have. I went to high school at Lane Technical High School for the first year. That's a huge public high school that was all boys at the time, since has become co-ed. But it was kind of a technical magnet school for both preparation for college, but there were very few who actually did that in those days, but more to prepare people for careers, work life.
Mm-hmm.
I took shop courses at Lane Tech, and it was a kind of a daunting experience because I was a year younger than most of the other people in high school.
Yeah.
And it was also a long trek across the city from where I lived. I had to take public transportation, two buses, or a bus and a streetcar.
Alone?
Was that? Cars. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Nobody to take you to school. it was, you got there any way you could, but in public transportation, I think we had a bus pass as a student, so you could ride either for free or for very little. But I had to take a bus with a trolley for some distance, and then a streetcar. There were still streetcars in those days.
Oh, really?
On Western Avenue in Chicago. And there were about 6,000 boys in the school when I got there. I always say it's almost like a giant prison.
Were there uniforms?
No.
Okay,
no.
Just checking.
No, there was very little that was orderly outside the time we started and the time we ended. I think it was actually a very good high school, and I learned a lot there, but it was farther away from home for me to go there. I'd say it took me about 20 minutes to 25 minutes longer to get there than it would be to a closer high school. It was closer to the neighborhood that I lived in. And also the closer high school was co-ed. And about that time, at the end of my first year in high school, I had begun to notice that there was a difference between boys and girls, and I thought it would be much better, much more fun to be at the co-ed school. So I graduated from Carl Shores High School, which is a little further west on Addison Street, on the same street actually.
Okay.
but a lot easier to get to from where I lived. I graduated from high school, and I went to first year of college at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, Illinois. And the summer after my first year of college, my father became ill, and I don't really want this kind of detail.
More
than you want. My father became ill and went into the hospital on September 1st. I did not go back to college as a result of this illness, and he died 2 months later. He never left the hospital after he was admitted. He died of cancer, and cancer was not understood as well in those days. They had all kinds of draconian and seemingly cruel treatments of various kinds, cobalt treatments and things that made people wish they obviously anyone wishes that they did not have cancer, but they made it even more difficult. But he died on November 2nd. I was already working. I went to work for a construction company. Toward the end of the summer, it was easy to get a construction job because a lot of people were returning to school. And I went to work for a construction company that taught me a lot of things about construction. And it really served me for about 5 years, 6 years longer. I worked every summer for construction companies. I worked that 1 year through the fall term, and the first year, and then at the end of the fall term, I decided I'd go back to school, but I didn't want to leave my mother so soon after my father's death, so I went to the Wilbur Wright Junior College in Chicago, which was only a short distance from where I lived. In fact, as it turned out, it became even closer because I moved in with my mother and two of her sisters in an apartment. which was very close to the community college, junior college. At the end of that year, I went back to Northern Illinois and finished in the regular course of things in 8 semesters. I didn't lose any ground. I did lose 1 semester because I was out altogether, but I didn't lose the second semester of that year because I went to Wilbur Wright Junior College, which actually turned out to be a very good academic institution. At that time, it was not what we would call a community college today. It was really a junior college, and it was for people who didn't have the resources to go away to school.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the options for going away were private at the time. There weren't as many public universities. They weren't as large as they are today. And it was some really low-cost option to get a really high-quality education. I think it was actually better in some ways than Northern Illinois University.
Oh.
But I finished up in Northern Illinois, and then I went to law school at Chicago Kent Law School. It was in the city again. My mother had remarried, and they offered an opportunity for me to live with them while I went to school. And so I studied for the 3 years and lived in Chicago. while I was in law school, I had a kind of an epiphany. I had never cared much about studies. I always did well enough to get reasonably good grades. I think I had a B average or so in a day when the averages were not as easy to get as they may be today. There's been a certain grade inflation over the
years. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
But I didn't really put myself into it. I never thought of myself as a student. I thought of myself as a person who was there to learn some things, then go out and do something else.
Yeah.
And when I got to law school, the faculty there sort of inspired me. They were the first faculty members I had really gotten to know pretty well. Law school had smaller classes, and
that's good.
You had an opportunity to get to know people better. And also, some of the faculty members were only a few years older than I was. They were relatively recent law school graduates who had, for example, a very good friend of mine, Ralph Brill, had graduated from the University of Illinois Law School. And I think he graduated early. He was younger than his classmates were. He went 1 year to the University of Michigan to work as a legal writing instructor, and then came back to teach at Chicago Kent. He was only a few years older than I was, and the other students, some of them were older than he was. So, it was the first time I had been able to relate to a faculty member as a peer or as a person who I could talk to openly without trying to impress them or without trying to be somebody I was not, trying to pretend you were something. And I got really interested in studying law as a result of that, I did very well. I got a scholarship to study there, full scholarship, which would pay for everything, tuition, books, incidental fees. I got another, after the first year, I got another scholarship from the West Foundation that helped with other expenses. So things were pretty well taken care of for me. I didn't have to work very much. I did still work for the construction company in the summer because it was such a habit by that time. And also the money was a lot better than anything I could earn anywhere else.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And it was fun to be outside. I loved being outside.
We talk about the salt pills?
Yeah, did I ever say something?
In the pre-interview, you told me a little bit about the...
Well, it was a whole different era. For one thing, we didn't know anything about skin cancer. So you went out and you loved being in the sun. And I spent these summers, I was out all day, every day, from 7:30 in the morning until 5 o'clock, all the sunshine.
Yeah, all the sunshine hours.
In the shade. Most of our construction sites were not enclosed, they were outdoors. The part of the construction work we did, which was to lay the brick, was always outside, it was never inside. And we never thought about it. Sun as being something that was a problem, and I think I've learned since then. I've had some basal cell carcinomas removed surgically, and I've realized that what we didn't know about the effects of sun could have damaged all of us. It did. I mean, I don't know whether it'll shorten my life or anything like that, but it certainly has been an issue for me as I get older. Also, we didn't know anything about hydration. They do give us salt pills. Instead of saying, drink a lot of water, they say, here's some salt pills.
Retain your water, yeah.
Retain your water, that's right. It was a very primitive era in that sense. But I did also some other jobs while I was in law school. I finished law school, but I was still younger than my cohort. And I was only 24 years old when I graduated from law school. And I had to think about the military draft. I had looked into joining the Air Force and the Judge Advocate General's Corps. I looked into the possibility of going into the Army Officers Training, Officers Candidate School. I had also been encouraged by some people that knew my situation to think about taking a job in the civilian side of the government in a national defense classification. I had always been interested in that kind of work. I had just seen some of the first James Bond films that were being released, and I thought, gee, that'd be kind of an interesting life. I didn't really know anything about it, and James Bond as he was portrayed by Ian Fleming is a lot different than what the agents actually do in the field. But I applied for a job in the FBI, and I was appointed. It came first, and I thought, well, maybe that's fate telling me something, and I accepted the appointment. So in June of 1965, I went and became an FBI agent. And I think that at that time, you'd have to also understand that the draft was much more of a factor than it became later. There weren't any wars underway at that time, although Vietnam was just getting started. But basically, every able-bodied male that I went to school with had been drafted already. Some of them went in, some of them had deferments, few of them had deferments. Some of them had medical problems and were not accepted. I think there were a lot more people who were rejected for medical reasons in those days because they didn't need as many men.
Yeah.
If everybody got drafted, they would have too many people.
Yeah.
So they were a little more selective. But I already had taken my pre-induction physical and they wanted me. So I was not in a position where I could say, I'm going to just wait and see what happens. I had to take a job or take an appointment in one of the military branches in order to avoid being drafted.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in the FBI for 4 years, serving about the same as I would have been commissioned as an officer in the military. I took that seriously. They had an unwritten rule that you had to stay for 3 years in the FBI, and I stayed almost four, making sure that I went way over
the requirements. Yeah.
I didn't think about it that way. In fact, I didn't even think about retiring or resigning from the FBI until I was well over the 3 years. Anyway, I went to Mississippi, which is an experience that I think is something that's been very important to me. I don't think I could have ever done something with that year or so that I was down there. It would have been as valuable to me as the experience I had in Mississippi. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 had been enacted the year before, and in the summer of 1965, on August 6th, I think it was, Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, which was the last piece in the sort of post-Reconstruction era legislation that would try to bring the South into a fully participatory society with African Americans and other people participating in the same way.
Right.
But it meant a lot of change was still yet to come. I saw it after I had been down there for a while as being a rare opportunity because I viewed the events of the 20th century in some sense as being based on human rights. Throughout history, there have been many periods when the individual was not regarded as being the important point of focus for society. It was larger groups and classifications, what kind of people you were, and these people would survive, and these people would not, and these people would flourish, and these people would not. It was a look at the individual and the sanctity of the individual. And after World War II, which was in some sense a battle over human rights. I thought the worldwide consciousness of human rights and the epicenter of the continuing struggle for human rights was in the U.S. over civil rights.
Yeah.
And Mississippi was the absolute epicenter of this tectonic shift of the huge plates on the surface of the earth, social plates. Anyway, I learned a lot down there, and I will never forget or regret the time that I spent there. Then they assigned me to Newark, New Jersey, where I worked for about another 8 or 9 months, and then I was transferred to New York City.
Was New Jersey's where you met your wife?
Or was I was still living in New Jersey, New Jersey, but I met her in New York.
Oh, okay.
I was living in New Jersey. They had transferred me from the Newark field office, as they call it, which is right in downtown Newark.
Mm-hmm.
And they have what they call resident agencies. The theory of this is that there are field offices, and I guess there are about 55 of them in the continental United States, or in the 50 states. I think that includes Hawaii and a few other places, Alaska. But in the United States, there are 55 field offices. But then in those field offices, they have a lot of territory to cover. So in Newark, for example, they had an office down in Trenton, which was at the southern end of the state.
Mm-hmm.
If the people from Newark had to cover everything in Trenton, they'd be driving back, they'd make the traffic worse on the Jersey Turnpike than it was already.
Yeah.
So they assigned people to a resident agency there. They don't have all the trappings of an office. They might have an office in a post office building or in some other building.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have a full staff there. There are no what they used to call stenographers or clerks or other people. All that takes place through Newark, where they've got an absolutely secure office staff in a secure building, and everything is done to the standards of the intelligence community. In northern New Jersey, they had an office in Hackensack. Hackensack is in Bergen County. It's right across the George Washington Bridge from New York.
Okay.
So they assigned me to Hackensack, and I thought wonderful because I was more interested in being in New York City anyway. It was one of my offices of preference.
Oh.
You go in, I put San Francisco, Chicago, and New York.
Big cities.
I like that. I grew up in Chicago. So
yeah.
I knew I would never get Chicago because they don't send you back to your hometown.
Oh, they don't.
Not for a long time. It takes a long time. They want to really indoctrinate you, send you back home.
Yeah.
I think it was in part because they wanted the agents to be completely disengaged from friendships. You know, you might, if you were in your hometown, you might have people who were involved in things that you were investigating, and it would compromise your independence.
Yeah.
So I had put down New York as a preferred office. And then I was assigned to Hackensack, lived in Fort Lee, New Jersey, which was right on the GW Bridge. I could get to the east side of New York in 10 minutes by car.
Close.
So that's when you could still get there by car. and that's where I met my wife, in New York. But I was oblivious to what it meant to have put down New York as my preferred office. And one day I got a transfer letter saying I was going from Hackensack into New York City, and I said, wow, I didn't expect that. How did this happen? And the person that was my supervisor in Newark called me up angry. He said, you should have told me you wanted to get out. I said, I would have helped you. I said, I'm not trying to get out. He said, well, how did you get transferred? I said, I don't know. And he said, well, wait a minute. He said, was that your office of preference? I said, yes. He said, well, that's what did it, because they have trouble getting people to go to New York.
Oh.
So expensive. In fact, I can tell you just how expensive it was for me. I could still live in Fort Lee and work in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But every other office, you have to live in the area of your responsibilities,
mm-hmm.
At least at that time. I think they're more liberal about it now. But we then got married and we moved into New York. And I lived in Manhattan, just a long walk from the FBI office. And by getting transferred, they gave me a 50-cent token to get across the George Washington Bridge. And in New York, you had a very high sales tax. There was no sales tax in New Jersey at the time.
Oh.
There was a very high state income tax and a very high city income tax in New York. So I got a significant reduction in take-home pay as I went across the river. But we were happy to do it. And but it's one of the idiosyncrasies of the organization to have these offices of preference, and they can rise up and either do something that you like or do something you don't like at any given time. And I worked in New York for about a year, and that was getting, I was in the FBI 3 years and 8 or 9 months then, and I thought that that I should look around for another career. We were thinking about having a family, and it would have been very difficult in New York on an FBI compensation plan. They didn't have adjustments for housing costs. They do now, but they didn't then. So we would have had to move way out somewhere, and I would have had to commute in every day, very long commutes, very difficult commutes. People would carpool, and I could see how miserable they were during the week. And you couldn't afford to live on the in the suburbs where there was great train service, because they were very expensive. So, also, I was in a very serious accident when I was in the FBI. I had a lot of injuries. It was on a surveillance. We were doing a surveillance work. I worked on the squad in the New York office that investigated truck hijackings. And there were sometimes 5 or 6 a day in New York. Now, they weren't the kind of hijackings you're thinking of, where somebody gets out in the middle of the road and stops the truck and then pulls the driver out.
Yeah.
They were really usually either jobs that involved cooperation by the driver. So they pay the driver $100 and he would park the truck somewhere, and then they would come and get it. The people who would steal the truck, they would bring it to a place and they would drive it into the place. That's all they knew. They didn't know anything else. Some of them may have, but many of them were just doing that function only.
Mm-hmm.
And they would leave, and they wouldn't even know anybody there. They would get their money from somebody else, somebody who would send it to them. And then the people that were there in the drop, as they call it, would unload the truck right away, and then another person would take it out and park it somewhere in the street.
A lot of people involved.
And yeah, it was a kind of organized crime.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't know how it was exactly connected to the organized crime families, but I'm sure that there was a connection. We just focused on the people who were involved in this part of the organization. But we were doing a surveillance. We had a lot of surveillances. In order to do the surveillances effectively, you had to have vehicles which would not compromise the surveillance. So we had taxi cabs, which were kind of fun to drive around New York in.
Yeah.
And we had motorcycles, and we had a lot of different cars, and then trucks. We had United Parcel trucks, which we borrowed. For, I don't want to go into all the reasons why, but it had to do with the radio equipment. We had 2 people in the United Parcel trucks. One of the motorcycles broke down, so we put the motorcycle in the back of the United Parcel truck, along with the two agents to stabilize it, because we didn't have any way to tie it down.
Yeah.
And then we were hit by a car. The car hit us sort of on the side like this. We were making a turn. The car hit us like this. The car bounced off and pushed the front of the truck. I was thrown out on the back of this, on my back in the street, and the truck tipped over on top of me. Landed right here. I was in the doorway, and there was a dent in the truck about the shape of me. Looked like a cartoon.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was in the hospital for quite a while, and one of the reasons I have a hoarse voice from the trauma of the accident. So that was another reason for thinking about doing something else.
Yeah.
Only to learn later on that presiding at faculty meetings sometimes is a lot more dangerous than that.
Who would have known?
Anyway, I The fellow I mentioned before, who was on the faculty at Chicago Kent, had called me. He knew that I was thinking about leaving, because he knew about the accident. And he called me and said, how would you like to come out and teach? One of your professors from law school, a fellow named Ted Beyer, had contracted a form of cancer that let him kind of limp through the fall term. Actually, they replaced him the last couple of weeks of the fall term, but he wouldn't be able to teach in the spring term. He said, how would you like to come out and teach his courses in the spring term? Maybe you'll like it, maybe you'll want to stay and teach, maybe you won't, but you'll be out here in Chicago, and this is where I was thinking about going back to practice law.
Mm-hmm.
I knew a lot of people in law firms, and some had contacted me, and I thought if I was out there teaching, it'd be a good way to get myself back into the life of law in Chicago. I was already passed the bar exam there and had my license to practice law. So I said, yes, I think it'd be fun to do it. We talked about it, my wife and I talked about it a lot. I wouldn't get paid a huge amount, but when you looked at the different cost of living from New York to Chicago,
yeah,
it wasn't bad. And my wife talked to her employer. She worked for John Blair and Company. It's a company that represented radio stations and television stations and booking their advertising.
Okay.
And so they have an office in Chicago, and she transferred to the office in Chicago, and we moved to Chicago, and I started teaching at Chicago Kent. I liked it. They liked me, so they said, why don't you stay on? And we started a family. We had our first child about a year later in Chicago. Actually, we moved up to out of the city. We were in the city at first, and then, but when we knew the baby was coming, we decided we had to move. Not nearly as far away from work as you would have to move in New York. But,
yeah, I bet.
We found a place in Glenview, and I could commute by train. It was pretty easy to commute. So the law school was downtown.
Okay.
We were all right outside the I liked it. I had a lot of fun teaching. I was finished with my second year, and I said to Jean, by that time we were expecting our second child, I think I'd like to do this as a career. She had since quit her job at Blair, so we were using my salary alone, and it wasn't nearly as much as it would have been as a practicing lawyer. But I said, I really think I'd like to do this. What would you think about that? She said, if you want to do it, then that's great. Let's go ahead. I said, well, what it'll probably mean is I'll probably have to do something to burnish my credentials, because somebody who goes to one law school and then ends up as a teacher at that law school will always be viewed as suspect, you know.
Yeah.
Only exposed to the people at one institution. So I looked into a possibility a friend of mine told me about with the Ford Foundation. Had a fellowship program for people who are interested in careers in law teaching. And I won one of those fellowships, and it was at Yale. So I went to Yale Law School the following year. I think I was the only former FBI agent who had ever been at the Yale Law School as a student.
Yeah.
They looked at me as kind of a curiosity. I wanted to know, who is this guy? I did get to be very good friends with some of the faculty. As a result of having been an FBI agent, there was a former attorney general on the faculty, Marshall, who was very interested in the role that the FBI played. And he invited me to go to a couple of conferences with him, but I couldn't go because of my schedule. But I finished the program and have a degree from Yale. And when I was finishing the degree, the people at Yale said, well, you shouldn't just go back to Chicago because you've been there, you've done that. Why don't you take interviews for jobs at other universities? So I did, and I got a few opportunities, but the one that I liked best and Gene liked best was here in Indianapolis. And it was not only because we thought that the school was similar in some ways to the school I had taught at in Chicago. It had a day program and an evening program. I thought that was an important part of law school's responsibilities. It was in kind of engagement with the community that defined my whole life as a professor and as an executive or administrator in the university. It also had similar characteristics. The Chicago Kent Law School was an independent law school. You find those, not as many as there used to be, but a lot of them in big cities. There still is an independent law school in Chicago called the John Marshall Law School.
Okay.
A big law school. Huge number of alumni, all highly qualified people. It's a good school, but it was independent. It didn't have a university affiliation. Chicago Kent, on the other hand, had merged with the Illinois Institute of Technology. This is the MIT of Illinois, or the Caltech of Illinois. Not nearly as well known, but a high quality university, getting better all the time. I think it'll be a real university of the future because it was inhibited for a long time because it was on the south side of Chicago, near the stockyards.
Yeah,
you know, it was kind of a grim place. As the stockyards closed, it was still in a very a poor neighborhood, a poor community, mostly surrounded by public housing. But now, its location is probably among the best for the future in the country. And it's in between the University of Chicago and downtown, but along the lake. And I think it's going to prosper. It has prospered already in the last 20 years. And the Chicago Kent Law School is a part of that university. But in Indianapolis, you had the old Indiana Law School, Benjamin Harrison Law School,
right.
And there was even a law school, the American Central Law School, that was tucked into an insurance company. They started their own law school, and they trained people in law. And they were all merged, and finally there was a surviving law school called the Indiana Law School. And in 1944, Herman Wells said that you could see the end of World War II, and there would be lots of people returning to civilian life, and a lot of them would want to go to law school, but none of them would want to go down to a campus where they felt they were much older and they didn't want to get involved in wearing beanies or anything like that, which was something that's probably not done anymore, but it was something that in that era might have been a factor.
My dad's told me about it.
It would be your grandfather, probably.
Yeah, him too, yeah.
But it made Herman think that there was going to be a law school in Indianapolis. It was going to prosper. Lots of people would want to study law, and it would be better if Indiana University owned it. Not only because it would be good for Indiana University, but it would be good for the people who study there, because Indiana University would upgrade the quality of the program. So in a way, the law school here was a lot like the one I had studied at and gone to school at, taught at, and I liked that too. I thought that there was a great period in law schools when they sort of became familiar with their university surroundings. They had a new way of looking at themselves. They were not purely a professional kind of trade school. They were a part of the university. And I saw the same kinds of opportunities here, because even though the law school here had been merged into IU in 1944,
mm-hmm.
and it operated as part of the law school in Bloomington, it was a division of the law school in Bloomington.
Right.
Even though that was true, and I thought it was great, the law school hadn't been as integrated as much with the campus here and with the community. So there was a place that I thought offered some of the same things that I had become familiar with. I believed in them. And that's why we decided to come here. Also, it was only 3 hours away from both my wife's mother and my mother lived in Chicago. It was an accident. Jean never lived in Chicago.
Yeah.
Her mother and father were divorced, and her mother remarried, and she married a guy from Chicago, so she moved there.
That's convenient.
Yeah. So, well, it was convenient, but we were happy to get a little bit away.
Yeah.
But we don't want to be too far away.
Yeah, and some distance.
3 hours.
Yeah. Was the salary any better in Indianapolis than in Chicago?
About the same, but it was easier to live on the salary here.
Yeah.
We sold a house in Chicago that was very modest, And we didn't even use all the proceeds of that sale to buy a house here. I mean, it was a much nicer house here. It was almost a new house here. Yeah, the housing prices are lower. The whole cost of living is lower here. So while the salary wasn't any larger in dollars, it was greater in buying power.
Now, in Dr. Gray's book about IUPUI, he noted that in the 1970s, the law school went through some accreditation problems with the American Bar Association, and that you were the author of a self-study that came, one of the chief authors of a self-study that came before the visitation for that accreditation. Could you talk a little bit about what the problems were and what happened?
Well, I was the chair of the accreditation, or the ABA accreditation committee for the law school, and we prepared a self-study. I wasn't happy with it, but I think we did a good job under the circumstances. There hadn't been a reflective self-study, and I don't think it was in the minds of the faculty and the dean at that time to want to go into a kind of reflective self-study that would have been better. But I think we did a good self-study of ours. It was a good standard self-study. Maybe I'm thinking about this in retrospect because I know a lot more about this now.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a lot of accreditation work both in law schools and in universities. I just did one this year. I ended my career as a chair of accreditation committees in California.
Wow.
But and that's probably why I'm not as enthusiastic about the work we did. But I think it was a good journeyman-like project,
mm-hmm.
product. And the problem we had with the accreditation had to do more with personalities. It was unfortunate, I think, that we kind of lost communication for a little while over this. It wasn't my personality. I was kind of an intermediary between the school administration and the American Bar.
Mm-hmm.
But it all worked itself out over the next couple of years. There was no jeopardy ever to our accreditation, although some people thought there might have been.
Yeah.
In fact, they were so concerned about it that the Indiana Supreme Court changed the rules on how schools could be accredited.
Really?
In the past, it had been, and as it is today, that you have to graduate from an American Bar Association accredited law school in order to sit for the bar exam.
Okay.
That's the rule in most states. But in the aftermath of that ABA visit, the Indiana Supreme Court changed the rule and said that you could sit for the bar exam in Indiana if you were the graduate of an ABA approved law school or any other law school in a state whose Supreme Court has allowed those graduates to take the bar exam.
Oh.
So, and they automatically said all our Indiana law schools will be able to take the bar even if they're not ABA approved.
Oh.
So I think in an excess of caution had provided for the possibility that the ABA would not reaccredit the law school here. I don't think there was ever any chance that would happen. We were
really
too strong in a law school. We were really a very good law school.
What were the problems that they were pointing to?
Well, there was a personal difference, and I want to be very careful about how I say this. There were two people in the law school who were both interested in being dean in 1973. This was a year before the accreditation visit. In the fall of 73, there was going to be a new dean, and William F. Harvey was one candidate, and James P. White was the other candidate. They're both very good people. I think Jim White had a lot more experience in academic administration. Bill Harvey was a frontline teacher and lawyer. You know, lawyers loved him, and the judges liked him. You know, he was the sort of person that I think if you were to generalize without going into all the texture that you have to really make this accurate. If you were to generalize at this level, you would say Bill Harvey was a lawyer's lawyer, and Jim White was a university lawyer. Mm-hmm. He was a person that universities would automatically be attracted to. He knew a lot about higher education. He was a student of higher education. Bill Harvey was a teacher. He taught civil procedure, basic courses, evidence, and you know, he'd get those students and run them through a very rigorous program, and they loved him for it.
Yeah.
I mean, he was the drill sergeant that everybody loved. Jim White was more of a reflective, philosophical person that was as interested in some of the other dimensions of law than just saying, here's how you try a case. And that's a gross oversimplification of all this. But anyway, after the accreditation visit, after the deanship search was over, Jim White was offered the job as the consultant on legal education to the American Bar Association. And the consultant on legal education heads up the accreditation for all the law schools. So when the accreditation was underway, the person that all of the people who were on the visiting team would end up reporting to was Jim White, who was the contestant for the deanship.
Yeah.
And when Bill Harvey saw the report that came from the American Bar Association, which was not particularly critical, it was probably about what you'd expect. But he read into that Jim White was behind the scenes trying to do him in as the dean by introducing the kind of competition that there was over the deanship into the accreditation. Now, in fact, I know Jim White didn't do that. He was very careful. He's a very, very careful person about this kind of thing. He had recused himself from everything that was related to the law school here. He did sign the letter that sent the message to the law school, but that was a perfunctory signature. Now, he had recused himself. He was just reporting. He was like the minute taker for the meeting of the accreditation committee of the American Bar Association. Now, in fact, the committee of the American Bar Association, and the reason they recruited Jim was he was sort of the kind of guy they liked. You know, they wouldn't have recruited Bill Harvey, in other words, to be the head of the
association.
But they did. They liked Jim White. He was, you know, oriented in a little different way. And for that reason, their view of the law school wasn't based on anything Jim White told them. It was based on who they were already.
Yeah.
And that's what they wrote back to the law school in the documents. And I didn't think it was all that remarkable, but many people in the law school were offended by it. And they became very defensive about it, and that caused a series of exchanges that weren't good for anyone. And it all just evaporated after a couple of years. There was no jeopardy ever to the accreditation. But people in the community were worried because I think they too, because they were Bill Harvey's staunch supporters, they too saw this as an attack on kind of their way of doing things, and they were trying to hurt a guy who had been willing to stand up and do what they thought was right as a law dean. And but it, I think, was never really a serious jeopardy for the school. But it did cause some ripples out in the community. There was a lot of discussion about it, and there may have been some fiery conversations along the way. But in academic life, you know, that happens. People are, they always say the passions run high because the stakes are so low.
Well, then at this time then, did IU Bloomington need to step in amongst
the arguments? No, IU Bloomington had nothing to do with it. The law school at this time, in fact, it was in 1968, I think, that the law school here became independent. Incidentally, that's another reason for the tension. There was some tension between Bloomington and Indianapolis, too, which was more personalities again than anything else. As a matter of fact, during the period of tension, I consciously, and enthusiastically accepted invitations from people in Bloomington to go down there and teach. Because I didn't do it to the detriment of a program here in Indianapolis. I did this on my own and above and beyond other things I was doing. I went down there, for example, in the summers to teach, so I wasn't teaching here. And I think that the tensions between the two law schools, I don't think really have much to do with it, except that the ABA may have said, well, up until your last accreditation, you were part of Bloomington.
Right.
And when you were part of Bloomington, we thought one thing of you. You know, we can accept that. We know the people in Bloomington. It's been a great program for a long, long time. I think the law school in Bloomington goes back probably at that time 100 years already. So they didn't worry about Indianapolis as much. But when it became its own independent school with its own dean and its own vision for the future, then I think that they might have said to themselves, hey, let's look a little more closely at this.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to just give them a pass. And that may have had something to do with it, but I really don't think so. I think that the ABA Visitation Committee did a straight-up job. This is a group that came from, you know, they had a couple of professors and a couple of lawyers and a judge, you know, and they came here, and I think they did a good job. They reported their work, and I think the Accreditation Committee, which is the group of ABA lawyers and law professors who get the reports from the people who go out in the field, I think they did a reasonably good job of taking the material and looking at it and giving some constructive comments to the law school here.
What were some of those comments?
The one that was most inflammatory was something like, and you'll understand this, I think, after what I've told you about the differences of viewpoint, they said that you should think more about being a law school that helps students prepare for lives of statesmanship, not just craftsmanship.
Oh.
Those are the inflammatory words. But I can see that. That's a conversation that law faculties have all the time. They have some faculty members who teach a lot of what they teach is designed to help students get through the bar exam.
Yeah.
Now, they don't do it consciously that way, but in fact, that's what they deal with. They deal with doctrine, and they deal with, you know, interpreting statutes, and they help people learn the law.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other faculty members who say, we ought to stretch our students a little more. We ought to be teaching them perspectives on law. We ought to be teaching them so that they're better able to deal with challenges they may have. In fact, I taught a course called Leadership in Law in the law school, which I think would be viewed as kind of one of these perspective courses.
Yeah.
And I thought it was very practical, even though we didn't talk about how to file a complaint in a civil action in court.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about things that I thought these law students were going to have to deal with in their lives. They were more abstract, but real, nevertheless. So I think there's always been this tension in law schools, and I think it was nothing more than that we saw in this. I went to the American Bar Association meeting this summer after this happened, and I talked to people there, and they were a little put out by some of the things that had been said, but they said, well, you know, these things happen, we move on. And they certainly didn't, I don't think they looked into any action that would have been adverse to the school here.
Were there any distinct strengths the IUPUI Law School had in the beginning?
Well, one thing is people have always been sensitive about calling it the IU School of Law and IUPUI.
Right,
like
yeah.
Like the School of Medicine, the School of Dentistry.
Yes, yeah.
So in fact, if it was the IUPUI Law School, it would be the only IU school,
yeah.
IUPUI school, because you get a degree from IU and,
yep.
And in history you get an IU degree.
IU degree, yep.
I think that there are some recommendations about little things, some compliments. They complimented on the growth of the law library. They complimented, actually complimented the faculty as being appropriately ambitious been working on good things. I think they were impressed by the student body. I think all the things that were really important, I think, were addressed in a way that should have given just the right encouragement to the school to mm-hmm. say, we're kind of on the right track here. We're recruiting good people, good students, good faculty. We've got a good curriculum. Maybe we should not have as much of a required curriculum. You know, those were debates were going on in the faculty at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the encouragement was there. And having been on a lot of accreditation visits myself, as chairing a lot of committees, both for law schools and for universities. Looking back, I think it was we were much more concerned about it at the time than we probably should have been.
What did the student body look like then at the beginning in the 70s, I guess?
Well, that's an interesting question because there were changes underway at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to do with the building, too. The building was planned in 1965. In 1965, I'll bet the demographics of law students showed about 5, 7, 8% women. By 1972, when I got here, I would say it was 35%. By 1975, it was probably 45%.
Wow.
Yeah. And in fact, one of the reasons for the growth in law school enrollments was women. The number of men that were applying, it might have gone up a little bit, but the number of women went up dramatically. So when you total all that up, it was quite a shift. Why did I mention the building? Well, the building was designed in 1965. They were looking at 5% of women. So what do you think they left out?
Bathrooms?
Yes.
It's always a concern of women.
Well, in between classes, there were these long lines outside the one room. So they had to retrofit the building for that. I think it also was a tremendous uplifting thing for the law school because there were a lot of women who came to law school who could have gone to law school anywhere in the country they wanted to go. They would have been admitted anywhere. But because they were here, because they moved here with a family, maybe they didn't have any children, or maybe they already had children, and they were old enough so they could feel comfortable about going to law school. One of our faculty members here was in that group, faculty member in SPIA, Sheila Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
You may have seen, if you read The Star, she writes a column for
the Star. Yeah.
Sheila Kennedy was a student in that area. She had 3 children already, came back to law school. I think she could have gone almost anywhere she wanted. And she was a student of mine in the first year contracts class. There were lots of others, though, that really enriched the student body. If you looked at the student body circa 19, I wasn't here, but I'm going to guess what it was like, 1966 or 67, it would have been mostly men. It would have been more part-time. There was only I don't even know if there was a full-time program at that point. And then you look at it 5 years later, 1972, you had a lot more women and a full-time program, and a lot of the women were in the full-time program. They came as a law student interested in getting a JD in 3 years.
Mm.
So that was quite a change, and I think it was to the great credit to Herman Wells. I don't think he saw the gender revolution as much as he did the GI generation, but he was looking at the need for a law school in Indianapolis to be part of Indiana University, to be high quality, and to be the place where a lot of the lawyers in Indiana would be trained. So that worked well, and then it worked well when women came here too, because it would have been very difficult for the existing law schools to accommodate all of the applicants, or anywhere near all the if we didn't have a law school here in Indianapolis. That grew very large. By 1972, I think there were probably 900 to 950, maybe up to 1,000 some years, students. It made for big classes. We were thin on faculty strength. We did a lot of teaching in those days. I think the average course load was probably 50% higher than it is today for faculty.
Wow.
And we taught large. I used to total up the number of credit hours I would teach in a year,
mm-hmm.
and then multiply that times the low tuition rates that existed at the time, and figure that I earned almost twice my salary by teaching.
Yeah.
I taught big classes. So, anyway, I think the law school, though, was well poised for a bright future. Back in those days, it seemed to me that it would be important to maintain the part-time program because it's the only part-time program in the state in a big population center. Maybe they let some students study part-time at Valparaiso, I don't know. But it doesn't have a big enough population base
right.
to really make it work. But here, you've got 1,800,000 people living in this area. In Chicago, there are 6 law schools. I mean, there are a lot more people there than
mm-hmm.
There are probably even more law school, more people in residence in the metro area there per law school than there are here, even though we only have one law school. But still, with a population center this large, you need a part-time program.
Yeah.
All the people who work in state government, all the people that are interested in, you know, they work in banks or in insurance companies and they want to study law. And this law school had the opportunity to go along with IUPUI, to be engaged in the community, to become the state's law school. I think that's happened more and more. Right now, in the state of Indiana, you have Indiana University Board of Trustees. There are now 2 graduates of this law school on the Board of Trustees.
Really?
Yes. 2 out of 9. Both elected, incidentally, not appointed by the governor. There are 2 people from the law school here on the Indiana Commission for Higher Education out of the 11 or so commissioners.
Oh, that's
The faculty member, there's always a faculty member appointed to the commission. There's a student member and a faculty member.
Mm-hmm.
The faculty member is a faculty member in the law school here, Cynthia Baker. The other one is me. I'm sort of a faculty member. I'm still teaching there, but I'm a regular appointee by the governor.
Mm-hmm.
I just accepted another 4-year term.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. You look around at the evidence of the impact on the state, and you see that of the people who are ranked as super lawyers, you know, that's kind of informal. These informal rankings are very, very suspicious. You shouldn't place a lot of emphasis on them, but they are one of the things that people look at. If you look at the number of super lawyers who are graduates of this law school, there are more than any of the other law schools in the state. You've got more than half of the judges in the state that are now graduates of this law school. More than half of the lawyers, I think, are graduates of this law school. You look around at the executives of big organizations in this community
mm-hmm.
and across the state, and you find a huge number of our graduates. The head of Clarion Health is Dan Evans, a graduate of the law school.
Oh, I know that.
You know, you find them everywhere. The president of the ProLiance Energy Incorporated, a very important company in Indiana, is a graduate of the law school. The list is very long. I don't want to spend time trying to remember all of them, but.
But it's very distinguished.
It is a great. I've always viewed it a great capstone education for the people who have been successful as undergraduates and want to stay in Indiana. This is one of the reasons why we've regretted that the funding levels haven't been any better than they have been. When IUPUI was formed, the budget of the law school was not very good, but IUPUI's budget wasn't very good either, so the university campus here couldn't do much to help. And that's been true over the years. I think all the chancellors have been aware of the importance of the law school as this capstone education, but haven't been able to do much because there isn't much to work with. I think Charles Vance is trying to do some things now. Because the law school on its own would probably be
stopped.
Okay. We will take a small break.
Could I unplug myself here and stand up?
Yes. Did it not trigger? Like it was, did it not
what?
Warn you or anything?
It was warning me.
Oh.
Sit too long in a position that aggravates it, I get symptoms.
Yeah. Is it from the accident as well? Or
it may have been. I don't know. But it didn't surface until a little later. But I had a ruptured disc. And when you lose a disc, you always have vulnerability. And you get what they call sciatic nerve symptoms, you get leg pains and other things. So if I'm able to probably walk around and get more comfortable, but I can't do that and stand in front of the camera.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. You'd be in and out all the time. But feel free to tell me whenever you need to pause for a minute.
Are we going at the pace you want? Are you covering what you want?
Yeah, we definitely are. We'll move into more of your time at the law school, and then probably in the, after this hour, then we'll move into being chancellor.
Okay.
Spend 2 hours on being chancellor.
Chancellor for 2 hours.
Yeah, chancellor for 2 hours. That's short chancellorship.
Okay.
All set?
Sure.
Whenever you're, we're fine.
Well, we've already used some of our second hour, haven't we?
A little bit.
We didn't start until quarter after.
12:25. I think it might be good if I went back and picked up a little bit of the conversation about
funding for the
law school and funding. It's been a challenge for the law school here. If you look at the ranking of the law school, it's been as high as maybe 65 or 70 in the U.S. News rankings out of 190 law schools. So it's in the top. It was in the top third at that point. Now it's down around 85 or so. It's still well in the top half, but the reason it isn't higher is because its funding level is much lower than all the schools around it. I think you could fund it better if you took a lot of non-resident students, but I don't think that's what the law school here ought to do. This is Indiana's law school, and I think it should be primarily for Indiana students. We shouldn't force, or certainly shouldn't take lesser qualified non-resident students just to get their tuition.
Right.
And even if they're well qualified, I don't think the non-resident student might show too high. So you can't raise money that way. There hasn't been a long history of alumni support, so the alumni fundraising isn't as good as it is in schools that have a continuous history of fundraising. Fundraising, excuse me, takes a long time to get started. It is kind of a process of osmosis. It seeps into the culture of an alumni body. And it's the really the energy and the donative activity of individual alumni that's that usually inspires others.
Right.
They say, you know, my classmate just gave a chair. Well, I might think about that too. That's more personal. It reaches more into a person's inner feelings about what's good in life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that hasn't developed as much in Indianapolis. It's getting started. When I was dean, we started, we ramped it up a little bit. When Norm Lefstein was here, he ramped it up considerably. I think Gary Roberts is doing more, but it takes time. And when I was dean, we had no staff for this sort of thing. It was pretty much what I did on my own. And it's very hard to do all the things, including I taught always.
Right.
I taught a course, and it was like being a juggler. I couldn't do everything. And so it didn't get started as well as it should. We did raise some money, and you could look at the fundraising. It goes up every year. A lot of the fundraising when Norm was dean was for the law building. So it may have been the kind of funding that would be one-time gifts, you know, for the building. But I think people that gave to the building are now being cultivated for other things. And I think that there's more of a recognition that the law school here really is Indiana's law school. And seeing all the alumni and all the people that are in important places, they would agree, I think, more now with the proposition that I advanced 25 years ago, which is that destiny is demographics, and the demographics of the state will involve more of this school's graduates being in positions that everybody cares about. And it is the capstone education for an increasingly important percentage of our bright students that sometimes they go away to school, sometimes they stay here to do their undergraduate work, but wherever they go to undergraduate school, they end up thinking, I'd like to go back to Indiana. And if I do, I know I want to study law in Indianapolis. And that's a very important magnet. And it is a pipeline that the state ought to be concerned about. And we are taking some of our best people and brightest people, and if we channel them into a really underfunded program that we're sort of doing on the side, not wanting to pay too much attention to it, just saying, well, it's going all right all these years, why don't you let it go?
Yeah.
I think that's an unfortunate conclusion for the state of Indiana. Anyway, that's the way I saw the law school developing 29 years ago when I became dean.
Yep.
And I thought that by the time I became dean, the accreditation issues were a distant memory. I don't think that we even paid any attention to them. As a matter of fact, my first year as dean, we had another accreditation system. But it was not early. It was in the usual seven-year
mm-hmm.
cycle. And everything went swimmingly. They were really happy. It was a nice visit. And then I've been through a couple of others as chancellor, I think three or four maybe as chancellor, three at least as chancellor, and they've all gone very well. I think the school's recognition factor is becoming better. Its ranking in the U.S. News and World Report hasn't gone up as much as I thought it would have, and that's simply because it doesn't have the things that you can buy with the extra money. Student-faculty ratio isn't good. There aren't a lot of bells and whistles that they can be credited for in the accreditation or in the U.S. News Review. And they don't have as much scholarship money, which means that they can't use a little bit of scholarship money to recruit students whose profiles will raise the school's profile.
Yeah.
So it's purely money. If you gave the law school here the same kind of resources that the schools in their range have to spend,
mm-hmm.
it would move up 10 or 15 places automatically.
Really?
Without even having to worry about how the money was spent. At least I think that's true. I'm not an expert in this, though, and I shouldn't qualify what I say. This is my belief. I'm not an expert. I don't think I'd have trouble supporting that if I looked into it, but I really don't have a background in this kind of thing. But I am convinced. I'm not afraid at all to say that the school's funding has been lower than the other schools that are around it, and it could make a huge leap forward in those rankings if it had just a little more money.
Now let's go back and talk about how you became dean of the law school and how that process unfolded.
Well, in 1978-79, I was a visiting professor at Ohio State. Actually, we spent a sabbatical leave at Oxford in England
in
the fall term. And then I came back and I taught the winter and spring quarters at Ohio State. So I was away during the dean search that was underway. This was a dean search to recruit a successor to Bill Harvey, who had announced his retirement. The new dean who was recruited was Tom Reed. He was then dean at the University of Tulsa, a terrific pick as a dean. And when he thought about coming to a law school where he had never been before, he knew some of the people, he had met them in the search process, to be sure, but he didn't really know anybody well. He wanted to have somebody from the faculty that he had confidence in come into the dean's office to be the acting associate dean for a few months until he got his feet on the ground and he knew other people and could decide what he wanted to do.
Right.
And he knew me, I guess, from other people, but in particular, there was a fellow named Orrin Slagle, who was dean at the Ohio State Law School, who had recruited me to be over there. And it was in transition. Orrin was retiring, but Orrin and Tom Reed were good friends. And Tom was talking to Orrin Slagle about who he might know on the faculty in Indianapolis. He said, "Well, I only know one person, it's Bepko, and he's a good guy. You ought to recruit him." So Tom Reed called me and said, "Won't you be associate dean for the full term anyway? I want to have some local knowledge. I want to have somebody I can use to kick things around with." So I agreed to do it. And as I was coming back from Ohio State, and then we got together and worked together for a couple of months, and he said, "This is a good team. We ought to work together for a longer period. Won't you take the job on a permanent basis?" I said, "Well, not permanent, but you know, at least take it for an indefinite period." So I agreed to do that. Then in the middle of his second year at the law school here, he was courted by the University of Florida to be their dean. And I mean, they were courting him in a way that I thought was not inappropriate, I guess, but mystifying to me, because they kept offering more money to him. He wouldn't even interview with them. They called him, said, "Won't you be a candidate?" He said, "No, I can't be a candidate. I'm only in the second year of my deanship here."
Right.
And they said, "Well, can't you come and, you know, can you talk to us about it at least? We can tell you some of the things." He said, "No, because I know that if I come down to Florida to meet with you, the Sunshine Law down there will have the media following me, and I don't want that. I'm just not going to expose myself to that." So they kept calling him and writing letters to him and offering him things. Finally, came into my office one day, because we had lots of conversations about this, you know, what should I do, what should I not, you know, should I tell him no, how can I tell him no, they're friends of mine, how can I just reject them without even going down there? But he didn't want to leave here. But finally he came in with this letter, and they had offered him enough money so that even if he went to sleep for 2 years, he would be a very successful dean. So he said, "I think I'm going to go down there." Of course, I knew once he went down there, it was
done. Over. Yeah.
It was 3 weeks, I think, and they had offered him the job, and he accepted it. So then, this was in April of the academic year. They couldn't find a new dean, so they had an acting dean. Well, I was the associate dean for academic affairs. That's the natural person to turn to.
Right.
So they turned to me and asked me to be the acting dean. And I agreed to do it, sort of on the spot. I couldn't very well say no. I wanted to be in Indianapolis. It was still my, as it is today, my devout belief that this law school is going to continue to grow in stature and influence and quality, and I wanted to be a part of that, so I said yes, I'd be happy to be the interim dean, or acting dean, whatever they called it in those days. And then I started doing that work. It was really abrupt because Tom left right away. As soon as he made the decision to leave, he really disengaged. He said, I'd like to stay here and work on a transition, but Jerry, my thoughts are all in Florida now. And they're calling me every hour, and I've got all this money to spend. I don't want people to think I don't want to spend it. I want to get down there and get started. So I was acting dean, but I thought while I was acting dean, if I was going to think about being a permanent dean, I ought to look around a little bit. And I thought, this was what other people advised me to do, to take some other interviews. So I let it be known that I was willing to interview, and I got a lot of interviews. I think I went out to 5 or 6 other schools during that course of the year.
Were they in the Midwest, or were you looking to go anywhere?
Oregon, California.
Oh, wow.
West Virginia, Missouri, University of Missouri, University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, University of Missouri, Columbia, University of West Virginia, Lewis and Clark University in Oregon,
mm-hmm.
as a law school that looks a lot like the one here in Indianapolis. It was the old Northwestern Law School, private law school that became part of Lewis and Clark University before the University of, or Portland State University got around to inviting it to be part of them, because Lewis and Clark is in the suburbs of Portland. Actually a very attractive place. I went out and interviewed a lot, and as I interviewed, I realized two things. I knew more about this than I thought I did, having been associate dean for a couple of years and having been involved in the accreditation business. After the ABA events in 1974-75,
mm-hmm.
they invited me to be on accreditation committees. So I went and did a couple of, I chaired an accreditation visit before I became dean.
Wow.
So, in fact, it was, while I was still associate dean, I chaired the accreditation visit. No, I guess I was already dean for the University of Colorado. But I did some of that, and I thought I know quite a bit about this. And I also thought, confirmed by earlier view, that the law school here and the environment here and the city of Indianapolis and the university here was a place that was more attractive to me than these other places. I looked at them one by one and I thought Oregon's too far away from our families, which were still in Chicago. California was too. I didn't really think that was very serious. West Virginia, Morgantown is a dreary, dreary place.
Really?
And so is Fayetteville, Arkansas.
Okay.
And Missouri is kind of, Columbia, Missouri is interesting, but as it turned out, I don't think they were going to offer it to me anyway. I was a finalist there, but I was interviewing here, and this process went pretty quickly. The faculty has to vote, and the constitution of the faculty is that anybody appointed dean has to have a 3/4 favorable vote from the faculty.
Mm.
It's a crazy rule because with faculty voting, you know, they can swing one way or another over a week's time. You don't want people out campaigning either.
Yeah.
I got the faculty vote a very resounding. The other candidates didn't get anywhere near the votes I got. So they put the university in a position where if they didn't offer me the job, it would have been awkward for them. They certainly didn't have to do it, but they did. They thought well of it too. So they offered me the job, and I discontinued any discussions I had going with these other universities, and I accepted the job. That was in March, I guess, or April of 1982, actually. I was interim acting dean from 81 to 82, and then dean from about the middle of April 82 till 86.
Would you say you were reluctant then to take the job, or are you?
No, I was.
You were.
This time, I wanted it.
Okay.
I think that there is a little bit of a reluctance in anyone who's leaving a life that they like very much. I like the life of a faculty member. I'm back teaching now because I like it.
What is it about teaching that you love so much?
Well, I like the intellectual challenge. It gets me up in the morning and I think of things I want to do in a class, and it excites me. It gets me energized. I think, here's a new way of looking at this, and it's fun for me. I like it. I guess if I weren't doing this and I didn't have a teaching responsibility, I might be doing crossword puzzles. Like
yeah.
This is fun for me.
Yeah.
I love to move the pieces around and look at it in different ways and challenge myself and challenge students. I guess there's also reservation about it because, as a faculty member, I always thought that the administration was too easily caught up in itself. You know, people get into positions where they've got dean titles or more, and they lose perspective.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that to happen to me. I was particularly concerned. I didn't want to look back on my life and say, yeah, I did some things and I got my name in the paper, but I'm not really happy with the person I was. I didn't want to get into that. But by the time I had spent a year as acting dean, I thought I could do the job and not lose who I was. And so we accepted the job, and I think it was an enjoyable period for me. I don't know how much progress we made during that time, probably not much, but it was a time when we were stabilizing, after the years when this ABA thing might have erupted. There was still some tension on the faculty. And then when Tom Reed came in, he was really a charger. He had been dean at Duke as an associate dean, then dean at Tulsa, which is not a bad law school,
mm-hmm.
and he was ready to go. He knew everything. So he got the faculty really working, and they were unsettled. They were happily unsettled, but they were still unsettled. So during the period that I was there as dean, I think we consolidated those gains. I was fully a part of the Tom Reed initiatives. We redid the curriculum. We created a whole new understandings about faculty work, which is very important. How much do people work?
Mm-hmm.
We had some faculty members who were teaching tiny courses with very small enrollments. And then we had some other people teaching huge courses, huge enrollments, lots of credit hours, and big courses with 4 units of credit. And it wasn't fair, especially if the guys were women and men, women and men were teaching a lot and being productive in their research and scholarship as well.
Yep.
Some of the people who were teaching hardly at all were not doing anything else. We never had looked at that as hard as we should. We did. We looked at that, and we developed expectations. We developed sort of an ethics of the faculty, getting your grades in on time, that sort of thing. We developed policies on that that had not draconian teeth in them, but they were. We did say that it was a matter of professional responsibility to get your grades in on time. And if you didn't get them in on time, it was a breach of your professional responsibility. One faculty member, I said this in the kindest and gentlest way, flipped out. He had emotional problems later on anyway, but these are things that are important to a school, building blocks for a school to get better and better. We did some good recruiting. We recruited and started the Center on Law and Health, which has become very notable. For a number of years, the Center on Law and Health at IU here was ranked in the top 10 in the country.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's gone off the top 10 for a variety of reasons. One is Eleanor Kinney, who started it, is retiring. We recruited her from the American Medical Association, where she was a lawyer. She was a lawyer in a big firm in Cleveland and represented the physician groups there in the Cleveland clinics. She went to work for the ABA as the lawyer who drafted all of their policy statements on legislation in Congress. And then she came here, and we thought it was a natural for her to take over the center, or start the Center on Law and Health.
Mm-hmm.
And she did a great job. We did some other things along those lines. We had venturing into the international field. We recruited our first faculty member from China. You know, we've got a very active program in China now. Professor Wang Chun came on a program. I was a friend of mine at Columbia University, was chair of the American-Chinese Exchange of Scholars program. And he was on the law faculty at Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
He said, how would you like to have a law professor next year? We can pay a lot of the costs and choose somebody that would be good for you. And I said, yeah, that'd be great. So we took Professor Wang Chun, and that was a wonderful experience for everyone. He didn't speak enough English to teach courses without somebody with him, but he taught, and he spent a lot of time with faculty. We had a lot of seminars with faculty on the differences between the Chinese and the American systems. Okay.
What did he teach?
His field was what we would call a litigation group of courses. He taught the courts and evidence and civil procedure, and I think that was what it was. I'm not sure. But anyway, they had lots of. It wasn't my field, so I mean,
this might be a silly question, but coming from a different country, I wouldn't think all of the coursework would translate.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it's, you know, U.S. law and U.S.
He didn't teach regular law classes. He gave lectures, and he did seminars with faculty. That was one of the most amusing things when they were talking about the differences between how we resolve disputes in the United States and in China.
Okay. Yeah.
And after hours of discussion, they came away with the. One of the observations was that it was cultural, because in the United States, or first in China, it's an embarrassment to take your disputes into a public forum. People are embarrassed by that. They feel it's an invasion of their privacy. They don't like to fight about things in public.
Mm-hmm.
It's just their ethic as a people. In the United States, on the other hand, people say, "I'm going to go to the Supreme Court."
Yes. The highest, of course.
That's right.
Get the most people hearing about it.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a very cultural. Anyway.
So, during your time as dean, did you spend a lot of time working with any of the other deans? Did you feel like you were a part of something bigger? Did you like Dean Plater or
yes.
McDonald? You did.
Yes, I did. I became friends with Bill Plater. First I probably got to know best of all was Walter Daly, who was Dean of Medicine.
Medicine, yeah.
And Ralph McDonald, who was a good friend. He happened to attend the same church that we did, so I saw him every Sunday at church.
Oh.
But yeah, I got to know quite a few other deans. A wonderful group of deans, I think.
Would you say it was a unique set of deans, like a unique period in time for IUPUI to have those men together?
Yeah, I think that. I wouldn't have anything to compare it with at that time, but I just liked them all. They were all very talented people, good values, honest people.
Was there any competition between the different schools for status or even funding?
I don't think so. It was all pretty friendly if there was competition. I suppose over money there might have been some concerns, but I never got involved in any of that. I made my pitch to the the administration every year, and they knew what I was going to say, and I would tell anyone what I thought.
Yeah.
And I don't think we ever got. There was never any. I never felt any tension with any of the other deans. In fact, some of them were eager supporters of me when I was asked to become a candidate for the chancellor's job.
Now, when you were dean, was the Purdue campus was still not located
right.
with the other campuses? Did you talk to them a lot, or did you?
Part of it was. 1974, they built the first of the Purdue buildings. So it was already, there was a building here, but it was mostly the technology programs.
Mm-hmm.
Engineering and science were still on 38th Street. And I said when I was first, you know, aware of this, that I thought it was a terrible thing. You know, if you talk about the messages that are being sent by an institution like this, the campus is located right here in the shadow of the State House. It's the most visible campus in the state of Indiana. It probably informs people more about the importance of education, higher education in particular, than any other campus, because it's right here in the middle of everything.
Yeah.
And at this important campus, we had, in terms of the image we created, we have discounted the sciences and engineering by putting them up 6 miles away.
Yeah.
On a campus where the students were isolated. They had to go back and forth. You know, it was at a devil of a time between classes if there was only 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And I have to take a course down here and then go up there. There were all kinds of practical problems, but the more important problem was one of the vision that we were advertising by having science and engineering at a time in the United States when math and science education had become more important than ever.
Mm-hmm.
This goes back 25 years. I remember the Nation at Risk in the 1980s when Reagan was president. The commission said that if a foreign country had done to us what we have done to ourselves through our educational system, we would consider it an act of war because we were not inspiring enough high achievement, especially in math, science, and engineering.
Yeah.
And so when I saw that, I thought that was it was a sacrilege. And I think that that was my view when I became chancellor, too. But I developed that view as a dean. And that was probably my first priority as chancellor, to get the move down.
So you did talk to the Purdue dean then, or the...
Yes.
Purdue campus
team. Well, I did, and sure. I think the deans of the two schools were both part of the dean's group on campus here, even though they're located up there, so they
right.
came to dean's meetings. That wouldn't be any different for them to come to the meeting than it would for the dean of liberal arts to come over, just that they came from
a lot further away. Yeah.
One walked and one drove.
So what did the campus look like for you as dean? It's spread out. It doesn't have all the buildings that it has now.
It was not as much of a campus. That was one of the problems. It was a collection of buildings, and it looked haphazardly distributed at that.
Yeah.
You had the law school built over where the law school likes to be, closer to downtown and the law community and the courts building. Not because that made people go over to the courts building, but it's just comfortable, you know. A lot of people do come from the courts to the law school, so it's the location it has right now is probably a good one.
Mm-hmm.
But when it was originally built on New York Street, a little further west, it was still kind of isolated from the rest of the campus. When I started teaching, there was a house across the street still, right across from the law school.
Really?
And in the summers, I was already the associate dean when this happened. In the summers, the person who lived there had a jam box. He put it in his window. Broadcasting his music all across New York Street. There was really hard to hear yourself think inside the dean's house because we're right on the north side of the building. There, we heard. Certainly, if you had the window open, you couldn't hear it. But there was a big bakery building at the corner of what would it be? It was at New York and California Street, I guess it was. And it was being used by the university, but it was obvious it was not part of the university. It was being used for storage.
Mm.
It didn't look like a campus. As a matter of fact, the worst thing about it was that when you drove by on West Street, which is where most people get their view of the campus, all you could see was parking lots. You look out there and you'd see cars. You'd say, what's beyond those cars?
Yeah. Field of cars, yeah.
Because there were no buildings east of the law school, and it was just all parking, and not a very attractive parking either, because some of it was still gravel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the sense of campus didn't come until many years later. And Spec, we're still working on it. Now you have more space filled. It looks more coherent, but there's still a lot of work to do.
Did you see any real identity for IUPUI at that time? Like a cohesive identity for the campus?
Well, I was law dean. I probably didn't think about it that much, but Carol Nathan had recruited me to be, or Glenn Irwin had recruited me to be on a committee for the accreditation for the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was on the committee that had to do with the community, you know, how does the university relate to the community? And that was natural for me because that's what I had always seen as being one of the dominant themes of a campus like this, was to be engaged.
Right.
And so I think that's probably what I thought. I think that our report as part of that accreditation focused on the engagement of the campus. It's not just being nice and volunteering for United Way Day of Caring, it's to be engaged in, at every level, research related to the community, teaching, developing programs that fuel the economy and the government and all in the community, having various kinds of service programs that students can develop in. I mean, it's a multitude of connections with the larger community, all of which are mutually reinforcing because it makes, I think, the educational program better if you can show relevancy. Even if you're not interested in being in Indiana at all, if you study in a program like the SPIA program here, or in liberal arts in the Center on Philanthropy, if you study in the Center on Philanthropy, you're going to be exposed to people in the community here who are at the cutting edge of work in not-for-profit organizations, and you're going to be exposed to faculty members who are on the cutting edge. I think there's no better place in the world than to have the best thinkers, the best people, people writing the books, and be in contact with the people who are doing and applying, and have all that available to you and your student. That, to me, is the essence of the urban university, and that's what makes it so great.
What was the significance of Chancellor Irwin and what he did to create a better sense of community and identity for IUPUI?
Well, Glenn was a great chancellor, and he worked the community as well as anyone has. He was very visible, did a lot of leadership roles in the community. I think he also managed the growth of the campus during his years very well. And he managed the university relations very well. He was highly regarded, dean of the medical school, automatically has a standing in the university, more so than the dean of the law school would have, for example, because the medical school is such a big unit.
Right, yeah.
It's almost a university unto itself. Even today, its outputs are extraordinary compared to the rest of the university.
Mm-hmm.
And Glenn was a genuine good guy. I mean, he was in fact, I learned a lot from him. He confirmed a lot of things about what I was like and what would be good to be if you were put into an executive position, whether it was dean or chancellor. He was a person who was honest and forthright and a good judge of people, good judge of issues, and altogether a good person to associate with. Friendly guy, too. He was never, he never lost sight of that personal dimension of relationships inside a big organization.
What would you say was most significant about his time as chancellor?
Well, I think that there were a couple things that were pending when I came on that he was involved in that I sort of picked up and ran with that I thought were really good. He was chancellor when the idea for the hotel and the conference center was conceived. And he was the one who put it on a fast track to get it done. I was actually the chancellor during the year it was finished. It was because the Pan American Games had been, in fact, another thing Glenn did, he really did lay the foundation for engagement in athletics. He was chancellor when the auditorium was built. He was chancellor when the track and field stadium was built. And he was chancellor. chancellor when the icing on the cake was started, and that was the hotel and conference center. And all of this was in preparation for the Pan American Games that were held in 1979 in Indianapolis. Now, this was before the Colts came here.
Oh, right.
It was at a time when Indianapolis was having a real identity crisis. They call it India No Place.
I didn't know that.
A cornfield with lights. You know.
That's terrible.
Well, it's a, you know, exaggeration, but
yeah.
I think Indianapolis had a confidence problem, and I think it related to education in part in two ways. Number one, if people have confidence in themselves, they won't get caught up as much in that kind of down-home Indiana, aw shucks, I'm not good enough attitude.
Yeah.
And there were so many students here that I saw. I didn't get to know them very well, but I mean, I saw them and I interacted with them, and they said, oh, me, do you think I could do that?
The Hoosier humility, they say.
It's Hoosier humility.
Yeah.
It really is. It's endearing, and it's great. You know, I'll tell you, the Kelley School of Business is a tremendous resource for companies around the country, and they recruit people here because they have a really good education, and they have Hoosier humility. They are not egomaniacs.
Yep.
They can manage themselves, and they deal well with other people. They want them to come out of their shell a little bit. They don't want them shuffling their feet.
Yeah.
But when they get that combination of well-grounded people with good values from Indiana and competency and all the things that MBA people have to have,
mm-hmm.
they find that this is a really fertile ground for recruiting the people who are going to go up the ladder and not burn out over some ego problem. And but on the negative side of that, it does keep people from aspiring. And
yeah.
I think that's one of the problems. And this university had a very direct role in raising those aspirations. When people came here, we weren't going to tell them, well, you're here, you know, you'll be here for 4 years. And
do your best, but you're from Indiana, so.
We're not expecting much, and you shouldn't either. Well, it's just the opposite now, I think. We're raising everybody's expectations for themselves, challenging them to be better. And if you didn't have a university here to do that, I don't think it could happen as well. The other side of that is, well, I think that covers the whole issue of an urban university, an outstanding university, not a place that people go to because they couldn't get in anywhere else, but a place that they came because the magnet of education there was more powerful than all the other places.
Yep.
That's where it's moving right now, I think, and that's great. That's what I observed as a law dean, and one of the reasons I was interested in being a chancellor was I thought I could make a contribution to changing that culture.
Now, I know in the past there's been some argument about sports at IUPUI and whether or not sports take away from education and a focus on education, or whether or not they helped create IUPUI's identity and sort of enhanced the student life. And what is your opinion of athletics?
Well, I know the differences of view on this. I'm not sure I am passionate on the side of athletics either. When I was talking about the athletics to Glenn Irwin invited on campus. Mm-hmm. This was a part of the city's identity crisis. And if it could be done in a way that elevated the university at the same time, that would be great.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it did. It brought a lot of people to campus who had never been here before. And maybe in the early days it wasn't good to bring them here because there wasn't much here. But by 1980 it was starting to, there was starting to be more of a feel like a campus. By 1990, then it was really going. We had more buildings under construction. We moved a lot of things to campus that were up at 38th Street. We built other buildings. We built a lot of buildings in a relatively short period of time, and that made a big difference. So if you have people coming here for the Olympic trials in swimming, and they look out and they see parking lots and an old aluminum siding building, they say, well, I don't know what's going on here, but it can't be too good.
Yeah.
Now they come here and they say, wow, this is a really major university. And I know that that type of image shouldn't be controlling, but it is a factor in how people view the institution, especially people from around Indiana, because everyone else in Indiana was happy with the idea that IUPUI was this sort of a collection of stuff out there. Don't worry too much about it. You're going to go to, DePaul, or you're going to go to IU Bloomington or Purdue West Lafayette or Notre Dame. You don't want to worry about that.
IUP,
yeah. It's interesting how deeply people hold those views about where they went to school. Now, as more people have gone to school here, I hope that they start to feel that way about their alma mater too. And we're going to have a much different view in the statewide. I think we do already. We have a much different view of what's going on here now.
Yep. I know since being here, my attitude has changed because I went to Purdue West Lafayette, so I always thought, oh, we're the core campus, so we're the big dog, and the IUPUI is just this other school. But now that I've been here and I've seen what they're doing here, and the medical campus is large and intimidating, and it's quite a lot to behold when you come here. So,
well, it is. More research income is generated here than on any other campus. That's been true for 20 years.
Yeah.
You think research that's West Lafayette, Bloomington. Well,
yeah.
No, it's here. but it's mostly in the School of Medicine, but more and more it's outside the School of Medicine too, because there are it was the other image we had of started to grow up when I was really law dean, is that this is a health university.
Mm-hmm.
You look around at all the academic programs, and most of them have some linkage to health. No, I should say most, a lot of them do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great strength. You can look at medical humanities in the School of Liberal Arts. You've got a Center of Law and Health in the law school. And there's a whole center of a different kind in SPIA, health services, we created the public health program a long time ago. We just created a public health school, a big gift. Very important. Indiana, 20 years ago, was deficient in public health. There was no school here, nobody studied public health. People were interested in it, didn't want to come here because they thought it was a backward place in terms of public health. And we started this program saying we've got to have a program, and maybe it'll be more for MDs, but MDs have to understand public health, and others are going to get into it in the master's program. We offered the master's program 15 years ago, I think, and it was accredited 15 years ago. But if you look at the result of not having enough attention to public health, it's that we smoke more, we're fatter, and less healthy than other states.
Mm-hmm.
If you have more people who are knowledgeable and willing to do the things you have to do if you're really knowledgeable about public health, your diets will get better, and you'll avoid some of the most damaging habits that people have. All you have to do is go over to Wishart Hospital, where the best emergency care in the state of Indiana is, and watch who comes in, and you'd say at the end of a day or maybe 2 days to get a full range of cases, if people didn't smoke, if they didn't drink, and if they didn't overeat, most of these people would have been here. The diseases and the accidents are all self-inflicted.
That's sad.
It is. It really is.
It's a little scary, yeah.
Well, I understand it, because I grew up in a generation where smoking was what everybody did. I smoked. I smoked for 15 years before I quit. I quit when I was in that accident.
Oh, yeah.
I was in intensive care in St. John's Hospital in Queens, New York, and I broke bones. Everything was broken, shattered. And I was getting fluid in my lungs from the trauma. So they gave me medication to help me clear my lungs. Well, I was really doped up on a lot of things, but even with that, if you cough, and you have all these broken bones, ribs,
yeah,
and sternum, and scapula,
mm-hmm,
very painful. And they say, you see, if you didn't smoke, you wouldn't have this problem. That was the most convincing argument I ever heard.
Yeah. Oh, man. So is there anything that you would have done, like to have seen done differently on IUPUI's campus as far as planning or where the law building was put or anything like that?
You mean, are you still on the days when I was dean?
Or? Yeah, dean.
Well, the one thing I wanted to see as dean, I got done when I was chancellor, and that is to create better space for the law school. The law school building that is now Eskenazi Hall, Heron School of Art, was superannuated within 4 or 5 years of its opening. It was just the timing of its planning. One of the planning elements that was out of date when it opened was not enough women's restrooms. Mm-hmm. But there was another one too, and that was they built that school to have 4 big classrooms and 1 or 2 small classrooms, one of which was a moot court room. What they envisioned was 100 students, a faculty member, a casebook. This was the Christopher Columbus Langdell method of teaching law, started at Harvard in the 1880s,
mm-hmm.
the case method. And by 1975, most law schools were expanding the number of smaller enrollment courses they had, so they could give a richer variety of upper division courses, so students could take things they were more interested in. It wasn't all a lockstep curriculum. And also, they offer perspectives on law, things that were a little bit different than just teaching people how to practice or how to go to court or how to draft documents. It was reflections on law, things that people, if they're going to practice law, ought to know,
right.
ought to be able to come to grips with. But these were smaller classes, and if you didn't have any small classrooms in the law school, so we're using spaces that were not intended for that purpose, and it didn't work well at all. So, and the library also. By 1980, the library space was inadequate. Now, you could argue this point. Librarians always argue they don't have enough space, but I think there was some truth to this, and we didn't want to deflate the library, which is becoming more and more a point of pride for the school. So I thought back in the days when I was dean that we needed some new space. Where it would be, what it would be, I didn't know. But I did know that the law school was inadequate. So that was one building that, even though we needed new buildings for a lot of the programs, to move them to places that were adequate, the law school had already a problem going back into the days when I was there. We had even talked about making the law library part of a new library that eventually would be built where the library is now.
Right.
The plans were not very well formed. Actually, that library got going after I was chancellor. But we thought if they built a library across the street, maybe there could be a law school wing of that library. And that would take the space out of the law school. We could use that for seminar rooms and all. But it was interesting. The law school faculty hated the idea. They said, there's no way we're going to walk across New York Street to get to the library. So the one thing they would agree to was if we built this kind of flying wing of the law building, like the, I don't know if you've ever run to the British universities, but they have these walkways in some places there between buildings up above, and they got ornate construction of it all, so
mm-hmm.
it's very much part of the Gothic and dated construction of the Oxford and Cambridge universities. And that's what I think they were envisioning some kind of a bridge they could walk across from the law school to the library.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have to be about 300 feet long. It would probably cost more than building a whole new law building. So that didn't get very far. Anyway, yeah, there may have been other things that I observed, but I think we probably are running out of our first time block.
Yep, we're just about there. Well, to wrap up then, what do you see as your most significant changes to the law school while you were dean?
Well, I think getting a development program going, getting a more active alumni association going, stabilizing some of the developments that were started while I was the associate dean, but needed some care and feeding even after Tom Reed left. He was the architect more than I was, but after he left, I became the architect and the builder and the person who saw it through. I think the developing a culture of the law school of high achievement, but good cheer, good friendly relations among people on the faculty. I think we taught ourselves that you could be high achievers, but not become embittered competitors. We could take pride in each other's work, and I think there was a cultural development in the school that was an improvement. I'm not saying it was bad before, but it was an improvement over what we had. I think we did some curriculum evolution. Some good things were done for the students in that respect. I think we developed this faculty ethic that I mentioned before, mm-hmm. of having responsibilities as faculty. It's not, you're not a king, you're a servant of the students. And I think that we started some of the centers, like the Center of Law and Health. I believed at the time that one of the ways to build the reputation of the law school would be to take areas of specialization like that, and where we got a lot of national attention, and build on them. The one that really was the best was the Center on Law and Health, where we dabbled with a center on international trade law. We even created the center at one time, and there is now a much grander international law program at the law school. I'm not sure they're directly connected. I didn't start what's there now, mm-hmm. but there were seeds planted when I was there that would have expanded the internet. In fact, the first international contacts that we had were the Chinese contacts that I created when I was dean.
Well, okay, then I think we'll take a break here and then
reconvene. You're going to give me about how long?